It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're talking about a collection of audio recordings of Wisconsinites talking about their experiences with war spanning more than 100 years. First, last week, Senate Republicans blocked a bipartisan commission to investigate the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol. It was their first successful use of the filibuster since President Joe Biden took office. But the move is pushing some Democrats to renew calls to get rid of the filibuster altogether. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that, the latest on infrastructure, and Vice President Kamala Harris's evolving role as the second in command. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's time to get rid of the filibuster? Do you think the filibuster stands in the way of big policy reforms? Or do you think it's valuable by forcing the parties to work together? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Adam Wollner is a deputy editor for McClatchy, D.C., who also happens to be from Wisconsin. Adam, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me back on.
Let's start right with the filibuster, with that first successful filibuster by the GOP last week since Biden took office. What happened?
Yeah, so basically the Senate wanted to, was trying to pass a bill that already had gone through the Democratic-controlled House to create a bipartisan independent commission that would investigate that January 6th attack on the Capitol. But unlike in the House, where you just need a clear majority in order to pass legislation, which is what they were able to do, in the Senate, under the current rules, you need 60 votes in order to get that passed. And the way that the Senate is currently divided, it's an even split, 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans. And while all the Democrats who were present for this vote voted in favor of it, Democratic leadership wasn't able to get enough Republicans to go along with them to get to that 60 vote threshold, which effectively killed this legislation that would have allowed them to create this commission. As you mentioned, this was the first time that this so-called filibuster has been used since President Joe Biden took office.
The filibuster is sometimes hard to describe. Even the U.S. Senate says it's a loosely defined term. Explain to us what the filibuster is and then why it's so controversial.
Yeah, it is a little complicated and in the weeds. But essentially, whenever legislation moves to the Senate, or I should say most legislation at least, it requires sort of a two-step process in order to pass. So there's a first vote that opens debate on a policy issue, and that's where you need to hit that 60-vote threshold. And so even if, for instance, you are able to get a majority of senators in favor of something to open the debate on a piece of legislation, but it doesn't reach that 60 vote threshold, then you can't move on to that second vote, which would be the final passage of the legislation. So basically, even if you are in the minority in the Senate, you can still effectively block legislation, and that is exactly what happened with this vote on the commission last week.
Are we hearing more Democrats saying, "Well, now it's time to end the filibuster. This is over"?
Yeah, you definitely felt some growing frustration last week that, you know, kind of an argument you heard from a lot of Democrats was that, you know, if we can't even reach a bipartisan consensus on, you know, investigating this deadly attack that only took place a couple of months ago in the place that we work, how can we agree on anything from infrastructure to immigration to voting rights? And, you know, President Joe Biden and Democratic leaders in Congress have a very ambitious agenda. They want to get a lot done here over the course of the next year. And I think they are increasingly seeing that without more Republican support, they're just not going to be able to get a lot of these things done. So you are hearing growing calls to end the filibuster, but we're still a long ways off from changing any of these rules in the institution of the Senate, because you still do have a couple of notable and powerful moderate Democrats who are still not quite going to those lengths in terms of calling for the end of the filibuster.
Our guest is Adam Wollner, who's deputy editor for McClatchy, D.C., and we're talking about the week in Washington, how what's happening in our nation's capital affects us here in Wisconsin. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Right now, we're talking about the filibuster. What questions do you have there? Maybe you want to weigh in on the latest when it comes to infrastructure and the Biden administration's plan, or the vice president's new expectations and roles. Give us a call. Ask your question. question or share your comment at 800-642-1234. Adam, what would it mean? I know you said we're not there yet, but what would it mean for Republicans if Democrats did end the filibuster?
If we were to get to that point, that would essentially mean that Democrats could pass legislation along a party line vote, at least for the next 2 years here, because right now the House is narrowly controlled by the Democrats. Senate is currently a 50-50 split. But since Democrats hold the White House, Vice President Kamala Harris would be able to cast a tie-breaking vote if that was needed. So, you know, of course, and that would be a whole separate issue in terms of keeping the Democratic Party together on major pieces of legislation. But if the filibuster was no longer an issue, then Democrats could sort of put Republicans off to the side, just sort of try and form legislation that could pass solely with a party line vote.
I don't know what metaphor to use, if it's a double-edged sword or a can of worms or something here. But once, if Democrats were to do that, then if Republicans were in the White House or if Republicans had more power in the Senate, wouldn't that be a problem for the Democratic agenda?
That's right. And that is, you know, what you're sort of hearing from some of the more moderate Democrats who are a little more skeptical of this idea, because you know, as we've seen in recent political history, you know, power in Congress tends to change pretty quickly. You know, it was just 4 years ago that when President Trump, Republican, was in the White House and Republicans controlled both chambers of Congress. So things can change very fast. So once you start altering the sort of institutional rules of the Senate, that can come back and backfire on you pretty quickly. So, you know, if Democrats were to get rid of the filibuster in the Senate, then those rules would also be in place the next time Republicans are in control of the Senate. And then Democrats would be completely shut out of any sort of debate. So that is certainly on the mind of some Democrats who aren't on board at this point with abolishing the filibuster.
This is more of a theoretical conversation that we're having about the filibuster, because the Senate has a lot of legislative business. What does that mean, the fact that they have bills they need to deal with and issues they need to take up? What does that mean for the filibuster debate?
Right. So with the filibuster rules in place as of right now, it makes things a lot more challenging for the Democrats to pass kind of the major items on President Joe Biden's agenda. He was able to get his first major piece of legislation passed, the COVID relief bill, by sort of circumventing these filibuster rules through another complicated in the weeds process called budget reconciliation. And there is a possibility they'd be able to use that same maneuver with an infrastructure package, which they're currently negotiating right now, where, again, you could sort of circumvent that 60 vote threshold. And you'd only need a simple majority in order to pass those to pass that piece of legislation. But of course, that doesn't apply to everything. So when we get to voting rights, to immigration, to some other things that President Biden wants to get done, that would still apply the current 60-vote filibuster rule. So with that filibuster in place, that is going to really hamper a lot of what the Democrats want to do, because up until now, we haven't seen a lot of appetite from many Republican senators, certainly not the up to 10 that they would need to pass some of these things to compromise.
Yeah. And you teased infrastructure. We'll get to that next. We're talking to Adam Wolner, a deputy editor from McClatchy, D.C. He's with us today to round up some of the top stories in national news here on The Week in Washington. And we want to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. We're going to talk infrastructure next. What would make a difference when it comes to infrastructure in your life? Should we prioritize investing in traditional infrastructure like roads and bridges, or do you see the definition expanding? You can call on that and other issues you see in national politics at 800-642-1234. You can also drop us an email at ideas@wpr.org. We continue the conversation still ahead on Central Time. We are talking about Vice President Kamala Harris's evolving role as second in command in the U.S. And right now we're taking on the latest in infrastructure planning. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Our guest is Adam Wollner, deputy editor for McClatchy, D.C. He's with us today for our weekly look at the top stories in Washington. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And before we go on to infrastructure, Mitch from Green Bay wants to join the conversation after we mentioned the January insurrection. Hey, Mitch.
Hello. I don't know why somebody hasn't investigated to find out who pulled the security in January. And if it were to be somebody in the Republican range, then maybe they would just censor it because it doesn't seem like you want security at in the Congress and take the security away.
Hey, Mitch, thanks for that comment there, because, you know, Mitch is saying, I heard Mitch say, I don't know why they wouldn't want to look into what happened on January 6th. And is that what Republicans are saying, that they don't want this commission because they don't want to look into what happened in the insurrection, Adam?
Well, a lot of Republicans had made the argument that a commission wasn't necessary because it would be sort of duplicative of some of the other investigative efforts that are already going on in other areas of the government. But, you know, but there also, you know, is a political angle to this, to be sure, where, if there was this bipartisan commission looking into what happened on January 6th, you know, there's a good chance that could stretch on well into next year, which, of course, is a midterm election year where Republicans are hopeful that they will have a chance to take back control of the House and the Senate. And this is not really something that they want to be focusing on. They don't want to be looking back to the events of January 6th, where President Trump's supporters were storming the Capitol, looking back to Trump's presidency. You know, they want to be looking forward and try and make an argument that's more a referendum on Joe Biden and the Democrats. So, I think there certainly is kind of a double-sided argument they were making there. But you know, to Mitch's point, you know, without this commission, I do think that, we're not going to, publicly at least, we may not get a lot of answers to questions I think that are on a lot of people's minds, you know, on the security front, to be sure, you know, some of the events of exactly what happened that day, the American public may end up being left in the dark on a lot of that without this commission.
Mitch, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you, too, if you'd like to weigh in. Ahead, we'll talk about Vice President Kamala Harris's evolving expectations, wondering what you think. Is the vice president the right person to tackle things like preserving voting rights? You can give us a call now at 800-642-1234. Let's talk infrastructure now. President Biden is meeting with the lead Republican negotiator in the Senate. What's at stake in that meeting?
So, as we were talking about before with the filibuster and trying to reach some sort of bipartisan consensus here to get an infrastructure package passed, these meetings are really critical because we're coming up here and we're already past the deadline that President Biden initially put in place. He wanted to have a deal in place by Memorial Day. That certainly has come and gone. And now you're hearing Democratic leaders in Congress saying they want to get something wrapped up here by the end of July. So, you know, we're having some more meetings here in Washington between the president and Republican senators. That he actually just wrapped up a meeting not too long ago with Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican from West Virginia, who's become the party's lead negotiator on infrastructure. And, if they aren't able to come to some sort of agreement here in the next couple of weeks and the two sides are still pretty far apart, we may see Democrats decide that, we're going to have to try and do this without Republican support. We have two very different visions of what we want this to look like and try and get around that filibuster and just pass it on a party line vote.
Infrastructure was the thing that I heard people floating even before Biden was in office, that they thought this was our opportunity for bipartisanship. This is where Republicans and Democrats can find common ground. Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's been, you know, something we've heard in Washington for a long time here, going back several presidents, that infrastructure has been one of those issues that could, bridge the divide between both parties. And certainly, you know, President Joe Biden, maybe not infrastructure specifically, but certainly during the campaign last year, you know, touted his ability to be able to work across the aisle dating back to his days as vice president and as a senator. But of course, you know, we live in still very politically divisive times. So even on something that, you know, maybe in a different era would have attracted a lot more bipartisan support, just the kind of the political incentives right now don't really lead to a natural agreement on this one. Again, you know, things are so narrowly divided in both the House and the Senate between Democrats and Republicans. You know, the next round of elections is going to be here before we know it, and both sides want to, you know, either hang on to their power if you're the Democrats or regain it if you're the Republicans. So, you know, I do think the president certainly sees this as probably his best opportunity to reach some sort of bipartisan compromise here over the next 2 years. And that is why he's pushing so hard and continuing to have these meetings with Republican senators to get that done, to live up to that campaign promise. But as of right now, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
And there are Democrats and Republicans who are pretty suspicious, skeptical, at least, of that circumstance, of that working together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, even getting 10 Republican senators, which is the number that they would need to get to that 60 votes, seems like a pretty tall order right now when you really only have, you know, a handful that are talking pretty closely with the White House at the moment. And then, you know, on the Democratic side, too, there are plenty of voices on the left who from the beginning have said, you know, let's not even go down this road. We don't want them to sort of water down our bill. And, you know, we may, you know, who knows if we can even get them to vote with us anyway. Let's just, you know, take advantage of, you know, the majorities that we have now, because we know that they don't last very long, and just get done what we can over the next 2 years, basically, before we get to the midterms.
We're talking with Adam Wolner, who's deputy editor for McClatchy, D.C., and we are talking about the week in Washington and how things are shaking out from the Capitol all across the country. We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, there's still some time. Now let's talk about Vice President Kamala Harris, because her work is changing. She's having more things added to her plate, including the effort to deal with voting and elections. What's happening here?
Yeah, so certainly since the last election, we've seen a lot of Republican-led state legislatures making moves to pass new voting laws that would, in many ways, restrict the ways in which you know, voting is allowed and elections are run. And that is kind of pushed Democrats to continue to want to pass a larger national voting rights bill. And again, that's, at least as of the way the rules are right now, that's something that may not be able to be accomplished with the filibuster in place. But those calls have been getting louder and louder as we've gotten further into the year. And just yesterday, President Joe Biden essentially said that Vice President Harris is going to be taking the lead on this and is going to be working to try and get something passed through Congress here. It's something that has already passed the Democratic-controlled House, but again, it's the Senate and their current rules where the issue is right now. So certainly another difficult task for Vice President Harris, who's already dealing with some of the issues going on at the border right now. But it, you know, Democrats want to continue to raise her profile. They see her as, you know, she's certainly already a prominent leader within the party, but they want to set her up to continue to be one after Joe Biden's tenure. But it'll be interesting to see how she handles this going forward, given that it's going to be a very tricky issue for Democrats to tackle, given the current makeup of the Senate.
You mentioned the situation at the border, and we've seen some confusion about what her role really is when it comes to immigration. Explain that to us.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting, you know, when you're the vice president, you know, oftentimes the job is sort of what you make of it. And obviously, you know, President Joe Biden has wanted to make her a partner in a lot of what they're doing here early on. And by giving her some of these specific policy issues to work on, you know, I think he's trying to show that. And there have been a lot of criticism directed at the administration in the first few months about dealing with the flow of migrants crossing the southern border. Vice President Harris is actually going to be making her first foreign trip here in a couple of days. She's going to be going to Mexico and Guatemala. So that's going to really be one of her first times, at least to be in the public eye, to make clear how she wants to address a very volatile issue.
And we saw Republicans point to Harris and say, you know, like, these problems are not getting solved. We still have so many people at the border. And then we've seen the vice president's staff say, well, we're not dealing necessarily with everyone at the border, but we're looking at how people are migrating here from farther south. Does that parsing matter? And is it landing?
Right. I mean, it's, the parsing certainly does matter, you know, from a policy perspective. But I do think, you know, Republicans have seen something to latch onto here where they're, you know, she's almost where they want to cast her as trying to avoid responsibility for what's going on at the border. You know, I don't think, you know, really for the average American looking at that, they probably aren't going to see much of a difference. So it is going to be something that I think she's going to have to address here moving forward. And not, you know, kind of have this stat, this posture of saying, well, I'm addressing this part of it, but not the other part of it, because, you know, really it's all interconnected. So I think that, you know, that's something Republicans are already focusing on. And that's something I think Vice President Harris will need to sort of have a clearer message on here as she continues to tackle this.
What do we expect to see and hear from her on this first foreign trip this weekend then?
And having just said that, you know, I don't know if we'll hear a ton of specific policy from her on this trip, because I do think, especially with that, this being her first foreign trip, you know, she's going to be meeting with leaders and you know, kind of making the rounds to these places. I don't know if we should expect a lot of news necessarily from that trip, but I do think it is an important first step for her as she tries, as she starts to establish relations with these countries who really didn't, you know, hear a whole lot from the last administration in particular. So I think this is just going to be sort of a re sort of establishing of relations with the new administration and these countries' leaders. And that will then, you know, allow them to maybe tackle some more of these problems specifically moving forward.
All right. Lots to talk about. Adam, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Adam Wollner is a deputy editor for McClatchy, D.C. He was with us today to look at some of the top stories in national politics in the week in Washington. And coming up after the news, we're hearing about a project that's gathering the stories of hundreds of veterans who served in wars going back more than a century. And we're taking your calls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did your parents or grandparents, maybe great-grandparents, live through either of the World Wars or Vietnam or Korea? What stories did you grow up hearing? Now's the time to share them. You can call 800-642-1234 as we get into that conversation. The news is next. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Still to come on the program, we take a look at a new oral history collection called Listening to War. It includes first-person stories spanning the Spanish-American War of the late 19th century to the Afghan War of today. Now, WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. As the K-12 school year comes to an end, lacrosse teacher Julie Welch reflects on the changes and the challenges of the year. Like so many Wisconsinites, Welch has experienced personal loss during the pandemic, but she's also found a new lifestyle she hopes to maintain as her work and personal life return to normal.
So I guess the biggest challenge, I would say, from this last year was not being able to be physically with people, not being able to touch and hug and be with my daughters and my mother-in-law and father-in-law and just the people that you just kind of take for granted sometimes that you can hug and kiss when you see them. We unfortunately lost my father-in-law just recently. He sadly passed away in March, and trying to say those final goodbyes during COVID was really, really tough. We were able to still see a few extended family members who had already been vaccinated, but we haven't yet been able to have his memorial service. So that was really a great loss this year for us. I've spent so much more time this year being reflective, being alone, being quiet, and it's been good. It's been really good. I have missed friends, and I have missed a lot of that socialization, but I've also realized how important the quiet is, and I'm hoping that this is a permanent change in my life. I guess another big change is I've become a dog owner again. We adopted this wonderful, magnificent creature named Mabel. She was a Cane Corso Mastiff, beautiful creature, and she came into our lives in March, right at the very beginning of the pandemic a year ago, and she just was incredible. I walked her every day, and we had long talks, and she was out there with me when we were gardening, and she just was a constant presence in my life. Sadly, she died in December. We know she was an older dog, and she had a pretty rough life before she came to us, so she didn't live through the year. We had her 9 months. And then another foster dog came into our life about a month ago. Well, she immediately adopted my husband as her person, and it was right after my husband had lost his dad. She crawled right up in his lap and would hug him and just gave him that outlet of, comfort. So we did officially adopt her about 2 weeks ago. So her name is Zara. You might even be able to hear her snoring in the background right now. I've just, in this last week, been experiencing that feeling of a little bit more freedom. I am fully vaccinated. My husband is fully vaccinated. Both of our adult children are. So it's like we're starting to be able to feel safe being together. And it's just this incredible, wonderful feeling. So I'm really looking forward to actually being with my children, maybe being able to safely get on an airplane and fly out to visit my one daughter who lives in New York City and actually enjoy time physically with her rather than just on Zoom. So I'm optimistic that might happen.
To hear more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/Outbreak Wisconsin. Now, we're diving into a new collection of veteran stories. Recollection Wisconsin has brought together stories of Wisconsinites fighting in and living through war. That means the Spanish Civil War of 1898, the war in Afghanistan today, and everything in between. What do you wonder about this project? You can call 800-642-1234. Are you a veteran? What story do you want to share? That's 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Our guests today include Emily Fotenhauer, who's a community liaison and service specialist for Wisconsin Library Services and the program manager for Recollection Wisconsin. Emily, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Brianna Fiant is the curator at the Bong Veterans Historical Center in Superior. Brianna, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Keely. Thank you.
Brianna, how does the Bong Center play a part in the Listening to War project?
Well, we were approached by Recollection Wisconsin and Emily back, I think, when they were doing an inventory of the holdings throughout the state. And we had a representative of their group come up to the museum and look through our collection and find out what sort of formats we had for oral histories, how outdated they were, how maybe they needed to be migrated to a new format, and then we just got on board through them that way.
And Emily, this collection spans more than 100 years. Tell us more about the collection and how all of these Wisconsinite stories came together.
Sure. So as Brianna mentioned, we had we started with a planning process, kind of an inventory process. We had funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the NEH, where we were able to send around kind of a field worker. Her name's Dana Gerber-Margie. And for a year in 2016 into 2017, she traveled around the state and talked to local public libraries and historical societies and museums, and basically checked out their oral history or audio collections. So lots of things on audio tape, VHS tape, reel to reel, all these formats that couldn't really be played back, to find content. And then we put together a plan and wrote a second grant to get the funding to digitize them, to get them all converted into digital form and describe them and then make them available online. And the scope was really broad. It was that whole span. We weren't expecting to find things as early as the Spanish-American War, but we did find a handful of things that went back to the 1890s, which was really exciting.
Okay, thank you for mentioning that, because that is a question. If we're looking back to the Spanish-American War of 1898, is there really audio from the 19th century?
No, so these were oral history interviews conducted in the early 1970s. So they were some of the earliest recordings we had, and they were interviews with men who had, you know, they were in their 90s at the time. So it was way back, much earlier than we thought. Yes, certainly not recordings from the time period.
But still really incredible that you know, almost 80, 70 years later, from when they were very young, they were able to tell these stories and share them. Let's take a listen to some of the stories that Recollection Wisconsin has archived. Here's a woman named Margaret Erickson, and her dad was an air raid warden when she was in high school, and that was in Superior during World War II. Let's hear her talk about that.
There were blackouts because at the time we had very active shipyards and factories and things that they felt that Duluth Superior would be a target area. And so they'd send air raid wardens out, and they had blackout curtains. They would buy these black curtains and you had to fasten them at the bottom. And if you could see light, my father would go to knock at the door and say, "I see light through your curtain." And he had just this little blue light that he'd shine on the ground so he could see where he walked.
I mean, we tend to think of blackouts during World War II as happening in European cities that were vulnerable to bombing. But, Brianna, they also happened in the U.S., including here in Wisconsin. Tell us more about that.
Well, Superior played a big role in the shipbuilding industry during World War II. And so, as Margaret said, I think that they were concerned that the Twin Ports could potentially be a target. So they certainly, you know, took precautions against that. I think here in Superior, between Superior and Duluth, we built almost 300 ships during World War II, in the 4 years that we were in the war. So, I think that the shipbuilding is a really interesting part of the Twin Ports history.
And we heard Margaret there saying that there were air raid wardens out and the blackout curtains, and how her father had this little blue light to see where he walked because everything was supposed to be dark. What more should we know about Margaret and her story, Brianna?
She has a really interesting story, actually. So after high school, she went down to Camp McCoy and worked down there as a civilian typist and clerical person. And so during World War II, we brought many of the POW, German POWs and Japanese POWs, back to the United States. And a lot of them were here in Wisconsin. And so she would register the POWs into Camp McCoy. And so she had a lot of contact with the POWs, and she had a lot of really interesting insights into that whole process.
Hmm. Brianna Fiant is the curator at the Bong Veterans Historical Center in Superior. Emily Fotenhauer is the program manager for Recollection Wisconsin. And they stay with us as we talk about preserving veterans' voices and other people who have lived through wartime. And there's still time for your call. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What family story do you know about your family members living through the war? Maybe you have one you want to share. Now's the time at 800-642-1234. We continue this conversation here on Central Time. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. We are talking about the stories of everyday Wisconsinites who lived through the biggest conflicts in history. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. A new oral history collection gathers veteran stories across generations. Our guests are Brianna Fiant, who's the curator at the Bong Veterans Historical Center in Superior. And we've also got Emily Fotenhauer here. She's the program manager for Recollection Wisconsin. And let's hear another story about living through World War II. Marguerite Pittenger took part in sending soldiers in Europe V-mail or victory mail. And here she is actually talking about that.
New York postal authorities say that you will send V-mail letters with lipstick kisses on them to soldiers overseas only if the kisses are properly implanted. They must be placed lightly in one corner and not overloaded with enough lipstick that might smear.
I have to say, it's just sweet that there's a very specific way that lipstick kisses were allowed on the V-mail letters, that they had to be lightly placed in one corner and not overloaded with lipstick. Emily, you can even hear her chuckling at the end.
Mm-hmm. This is a really fun interview, and this is part of a group of interviews that high school students in La Crosse conducted in around 1995. They're held at the UW La Crosse archives. But all of those interviews you can hear the voices and the laughing of the high schoolers who are interviewing too.
Oh, I bet.
A learning experience for them as well.
Brianna, what was V-mail or victory mail? How did Wisconsinites like Marguerite get involved?
So V-mail was a way that you would write your letter on a full-size sheet of paper, and then it would get condensed, like microfilm, it would get condensed down into a much smaller piece of mail that would take up much less space going overseas. So then when you get the V-mail on the other side, it actually can be really hard to read because the print is now so small. But it was just a way to consolidate and get more mail over in less amount of space.
Huh, how fascinating and how neat to hear her talking about it for sure. We're talking about a project from Recollection Wisconsin, and we're taking your calls, your family stories, or your stories about living through war at 800-642-1234. We have Linda in Milton ready to join the conversation. Welcome, Linda.
Thanks for taking my call.
What are you thinking about?
My mother-in-law and father-in-law survived World War II in Sicily. My mother-in-law was a teenager.
Oh, and Lynn. Oh, we may have lost you. Go ahead. I think we've got you back. I'd love to hear it.
She, as a young teenager, it was up to her to go to surrounding villages and to help identify family and friends that were killed in the war.
Linda, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Linda, you know, hearing these stories from family members, we just talked about some lighthearted ones, but there are also roles that people played that were really devastating, Emily.
Yes, for sure. And that's one of the things that is really important to think about kind of this collection as a whole is, like you said, we've highlighted some of the more lighthearted bits, but there's a lot of pretty intense stories here, both combat stories, prisoners of war. So it's definitely a lot of challenging content as well.
And Linda was talking about Sicily in World War II, though. And Brianna, the Bong Center in Superior focuses on veterans of World War II and the conflicts that followed. What do you see in those stories?
So we started collecting World War II stories, and it is very interesting to see just how different everybody's experiences are. The people who see combat, the people who stay at home. What I find really interesting, especially about World War II, is how much the home front got involved and behind the war. And as the caller was saying, even in Italy, you know, she was a civilian, but she was put to work. I mean, it really was not just the military. Everybody was involved in World War II.
We are talking about a project to preserve people's voices, people's histories when it comes to living through wartime. That's Brianna Fiant, who is the curator at the Hmong Veterans Historical Center in Superior, also talking with Emily Fotenhauer, who's program manager for Recollection Wisconsin. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Let's move a few decades forward to the Vietnam War. Yang Kai Moa was one of the first Hmong refugees from that conflict to settle in Wisconsin. And here he is talking about why some Hmong chose to relocate from bigger Midwestern cities to Wisconsin.
They moved from the Twin City, from Chicago, and from many of the big cities from the south to Wisconsin. And they think that it's not so big, so they can get their way around. So they picked Eau Claire.
They picked Eau Claire. Emily, Young is originally from Laos. What's his story, how he became a refugee and then wound up in Wisconsin?
So this is part of the Hmong story of Hmong coming to Wisconsin is following the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam, the end of the Vietnam War. The Hmong had supported the U.S. presence in Vietnam, and after the war, they were essentially sort of run out of their home country, and many escaped to refugee camps in Thailand, and then there were programs to resettle refugees in cities in the Midwest and around the country, really. And there's several cities in Wisconsin that have, the population the migration kind of built up over time, and Eau Claire, La Crosse, Wausau is another significant area, but really all over the state. And this interview comes from a great group of interviews done by the Chippewa Valley Museum in Eau Claire. They started working with the Hmong community in Eau Claire in the 1990s and have collected great information about their stories, both in Vietnam and Laos, and then their experiences after they came to Wisconsin.
Yeah, more evidence of that collaboration. We've got Sandy in Sturgeon Bay on the phone now. Hey, Sandy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what is this conversation bringing up for you?
Well, my grandparents met during World War I. And my grandfather was wounded. The story is that his toes were blown off by a cannonball, and so he was shipped home, and she was an ambulance driver in the New York area. And so they met when she took him to the hospital, and her father would invite soldiers to Sunday dinner. So he got to be one of those, and thus the story began. They got married a few years later.
Oh, how fun. Sandy, thank you for sharing that story. Thank you, everyone who shared your stories. Brianna, what's it like to listen to people talk about living through these extraordinary times?
I feel very privileged that I have this job and that I do get to hear these stories. Everybody just amazes me with their insight into what they've gone through and their willingness to share, because a lot of the things that they're sharing are probably traumatic experiences, but they want to share it with our staff and our volunteers here who are taking the oral histories, and they want to share it with future generations, and I find it very inspirational.
Mm. Brianna, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Emily, we appreciate you talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Fotenhauer is a community liaison and service specialist for Wisconsin Library Services and program manager for Recollection Wisconsin. And Brianna Fiant is the curator at the Hmong Veterans Historical Center in Superior. And if you've got more to say on this topic, you can always send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a new study finds homes in predominantly white neighborhoods in the Milwaukee area are worth nearly four times the homes that are in predominantly black neighborhoods. And that makes the Milwaukee metropolitan area the sixth most inequitable region for real estate in the country. We've got the details on that. And as people clean out and organize their stuff, donations pile up. Donation centers accept whatever people can spare. Our guest says some of it helps, while the rest isn't suitable for reuse. Find out what's best for your donation drop-off tomorrow on Central Time. You can join us right here from 3 until 6. We credit cows with quite a bit when it comes to Wisconsin's agriculture, our economy, and our reputation as America's dairyland. Now, maybe for law enforcement, too? Officials report that earlier this week, the Barron County Sheriff's Department and Barron Police chased a car for about 13 miles between Barron and Cumberland. On Facebook, the sheriff's office posted that it ended on a farm. And we would be remiss if we didn't thank the Barron County Bovine Unit for jumping into the fray when the vehicle came into their patrol area. That's right, the bovine unit. See, the cavalier involved in the chase, cattle blocked the car, and that's how the chase ended. The sheriff's department posted a photo of the car at night. It stopped in the grass with its headlights aimed straight ahead, and there, all lined up, almost posing for the camera, you can see at least 15 cattle. Authorities say no humans or cattle were hurt in the chase. They also posted, "Job well done tonight, crew." Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network.